This is CliffCentral.com.
Kanthan Pillay and Pumi Mashiko are here. We're going to talk about all the issues in the news this week. The Burning Platform brought to you by Nando's. Good morning, Pumi and Kanthan.
Gareth, how are you doing?
Is it a good morning?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant.
All right, so first things first. We had a big deal in Parliament this week. I think it was a big deal because it was a bit of a wake-up call for a party that's forgotten that they're a minority party. The EFF tabled a motion to have the airport in Cape Town renamed after Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and they were roundly defeated. I think the numbers were, you know, there were like 11 members who voted for it, and there were 6 abstentions, and the rest were all against from all the other parties. Now, I think we can analyze whether or not this is an ultimatum on the legacy of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, or whether it's actually a statement about how powerful the EFF are or are not. But your thoughts on that initially?
Correct answer is none of the above.
Okay.
Starting point is that it's not Parliament's role to determine whether places get renamed.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, okay. It isn't. And in fact, if they had passed a resolution to that effect, it would have been tossed out by the Constitutional Court. So they have no jurisdiction.
So is this grandstanding, or is this a lack of understanding?
It is absolute grandstanding.
Is it also a lack of understanding about what Parliament's purpose is?
Not at all.
Understand
that the EFF does everything for the sake of grandstanding. And of course, everyone in the mainstream media, does such a beast still exist? Everyone in the mainstream media basically laps up this stuff and they start gleefully rubbing their hands together. But it doesn't actually work that way, guys.
So maybe you agree then with the Vryheidsfront Plus leader, Corné Mulder, who had something to say about what we should do with airports. So take a listen to this quickly and see if you agree. And what we name things generally, because that there seems to be a spate of people naming things and therefore imagining that those problems that are around these places in these areas.
I'm in favor of the renaming of Grahamstown because I think, you know, Graham, whoever he was, you know, would be
embarrassed. To be involved.
Yeah. So, give it
a new name.
A nice new name that reflects the what did Donald Trump describe us as?
A shithole.
Yeah, that was.
He described a lot of countries as shitholes. I don't think he actually said us, and he of course denies he ever used the term. But then, who knows?
Yes.
Here's Corné Mulder.
You have to look at names that make sense. And if you come to the Western Cape, if you come to the Western Cape, you must also respect the people, the indigenous people in the Western Cape originally. You must respect the First Nation in the Western Cape. You must respect the minorities in the Western Cape. And then it makes sense to look at a name like Kratua. And I know that people feel very strongly about that. And we believe that that name should be put on the table as a possible name that should be considered. Honourable Deputy Speaker, the
Speaker
wants to ask something.
Yes, Honourable Member.
Will the Member take a question?
Yes, I'll take a question.
The man outside the Parliament buildings, was he born here?
Of course he was born here. You're completely ignorant.
Here in Parliament? Was he born here in Parliament?
One day, Honourable Minister, one day, you should come and I will explain to you who General Louis Botha was.
Oh my God.
You don't know your history. You don't know where people come from. You've got no idea.
Were they talking about the Mandela statue outside of Parliament?
I have no idea.
But this becomes the culture wars.
Let's just go back to, you know, a bit of historical context here. When we go back to the times of Codessa, which most people have actually forgotten. In the first place, guys, let's be very clear. The ANC did not liberate this country. We had a negotiated settlement between the apartheid government at the time and between all of the other parties that were gathered together, of which the ANC was the majority party. So an agreement was reached at Codessa that certain rules would be obeyed. And one of the things that came out of the Codessa talks was that in order to move the country forward, airports in particular were going to be given geographical names. So at that time, Cape Town was no longer DF Malan. It became Cape Town International.
Oh, that's right. It was DF Malan before.
Yes.
I forgot about
Durban
that.
Used to be Louis Botha. Durban right. Became Durban International.
Right. Joburg was Jan Smuts. It became O.R. Tambo.
Became Joburg International. George used to be P.W. Botha. That became George. Now, we got to the point sort of post the Mandela era, where suddenly people said, well, let's take Joburg International and rename it after O.R. Tambo. And I had huge problems with that, because basically there was an agreement at the time of CODESA. And don't get me wrong, okay? Do I think that it's worth naming stuff after O.R. Tambo? Absolutely. But the agreement at the time of CODESA was that we were going to put those names behind us. We were going to focus on geographic locations, because that was a way to actually take us forward as a nation. Mm. So the naming of Joburg International after O.R. Tambo was a problem, because basically it meant that the rules of engagement that were put in place at the time of CODESA were broken. Now, I didn't have a problem with the new airport in Durban being named King Shaka, because it was new. It was something that had been built post-apartheid, mm-hmm. and it's perfectly okay to do that. So when we built this bridge in downtown Johannesburg, right next to the Queen Elizabeth Bridge, we called it the Nelson Mandela Bridge. It's great. It's mm-hmm. it's something new that we built. But this idea now of wanting to turn around and go back on that agreement that was reached at the time, it was a good faith agreement. I think that that's actually seriously pathetic. You know, by all means, you want to name something after Winnie Mandela, build something new. But this historical revisionism really sucks. But here's my question in terms of why the EFF was pushing Winnie Mandela. Who is the chairman of the EFF?
Dalimpofu.
Okay. And who was responsible for the breakup of Nelson Mandela's marriage because of an inappropriate relationship with Winnie Mandela?
Dalimpofu.
Okay. So, in other words, what we have is this party in parliament wanting to name an airport after the side chick of the chairman.
Yo!
No. Yo! Not the side chick of the chairman. Not the side chick of the chairman. Understand that he was the Benten.
Thank you for clarifying. But you guys see the absurdity
there
of this
stuff. There is a different power relationship. I'm with Pumi on
that.
But
guys,
yeah.
Do you see the absurdity of this stuff?
Yeah, it's kind of childish, right?
It's really pathetic, guys.
Yeah.
You know, the EFF, every time we have a conversation about the EFF, and we've just spoken about them, at even their student chapter, the absurdity of it all, right? The terrible and unfortunate thing about the EFF is that they have positioned themselves into the space in our politics. And that space is one where they do get a fair share of media coverage.
No, I disagree. They didn't position themselves, Pumi. You know, it was the idiots in the media who are now who are now turning around and they're having tantrums because of the fact
that the EFF
has no respect for press freedom, for example. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, oh, it's but unfair, he never did. But we gave you all this press.
But they have this power. They have this power, and they need, you know, they need like Spider-Man's auntie to tell them that with great power comes great responsibility.
Oh my God. All right.
They do. You know, they are so irresponsible on so many levels.
You know, my personal feelings about Winnie Mandela are very strong. Abu Asfat was a friend of mine.
I want to get into this. Mm-hmm. I think that this, and I don't by any means mean to denigrate the importance of this, and I do want to talk about it in a second, but we have someone on the line. We are in an election year. There are lots of people who want to talk about what their plans are. Just last week, we spoke to Stephens Mokgalapa from the DA about Tswane. He's the new mayor there, Solly Msimanga has been squeezed into the premier role for the upcoming elections as the DA candidate. So this week we're going to talk to the Vryheidsfront Plus. They are a minority party in parliament. Advocate Anton Alberts is an MP and the FF Plus's premier candidate. For which province are you the premier candidate? Anton? Are you still getting it?
Still connecting. The Skyping is still connecting.
Right, good. Well, I'll find out which premier he's the candidate for, which province he's the premier candidate for. We'll talk to him about the manifesto, which was launched on I think it was launched this weekend, and they are talking about things like, when you vote, be rational, look at the different political parties, what they offer you, whether they make false promises. We don't make false promises, they say, but then every politician in history has said that, so I don't know whether that's anything to go on. They launched their manifesto this morning, at the Rockwood Theatre in Pretoria. So let's find out from him what's going on. This is fresh, hot off the press, and we get to speak to him now. Good morning. Hello, Anton, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you, Gareth.
Very good. Anton, congratulations on your manifesto launch. What's in it that we need to know? What do you want South Africans to know about the Freedom Front?
Gareth, in a nutshell, I think we're the last party in Parliament that actually wants to protect the free market. And we know that, gathered from evidence all around the world, that that's the only way to really uplift all South Africans and to develop South Africans and give everybody a chance to move up out of poverty into the middle class, which is always important for a democracy. Without a strong middle class, a democracy is always under threat.
All right, I'm going to hand over to Canton and to Pumi to ask you a few questions. It is election year, so there's a chance for you to tell the story of the Vryheidsfront Plus and to see if you can gather some voters. Pumi?
Okay, thank you.
Age before beauty, Canton.
All right, Canton,
thank you very much.
First,
good morning, right. Anton. How are you doing?
Hi there, everyone.
Okay. Look, just as a kind of opening spiel, give me a sense of where you see yourselves ending up after this election. I haven't been tracking historic performance of Freedom Front Plus recently, but I'm sure you guys have been doing your research and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to have a sense of where you expect to see gains and what type of voters you're expecting to pull across this time.
Well, our focus is mainly on minority rights. So our voters mostly would be from, let's say, ex-DA voters who are not happy anymore. It comes from the minority groups. And if we look at the research, we do show that we're on the radar, and it does show that we are growing. We are always very careful about future projections, but it does look promising for us, and our own research, which is not as scientific as the ones that we've seen, also supports what is happening out there. And I think we're seeing a bit of a realignment of political support in South Africa, where there's a movement away from three large parties, except perhaps the EFF at this stage, to smaller parties, which provides more of a spread of power in the whole system, and that bodes well for coalition politics, especially in Gauteng.
Pumi?
Anton, I'm interested that your slogan this year is Fight Back, which reminds me of Tony Leon's last slogan at the DA. Are you hoping to, in the madness of the DA, are you hoping to win some DA voters across?
Oh, yes, we are definitely hoping to do that. We know there's a lot of disaffection within the DA itself, especially among minority groupings. And the Fight Back slogan was actually taken as a whole to say Fight Back South Africa. And the whole context is that we stand up against the ANC's policies. Well, the policies on the one hand, but also their actions on the other hand, that looks like it's purely out to go on a looting spree of South Africans' institutions and taking our tax money and abusing it and not sending it where it's supposed to go in the first place.
So, Anton, the Fight Back, you're saying the policies of the ANC, do you believe that none of the policies of the ANC have been beneficial to South Africa in any way?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat your question?
Do you believe that all the ANC policies have done damage and not necessarily been beneficial to South Africa, or is it just a few?
No, not all of it. I mean, obviously, the housing policies, some of the trade and industry policies, the incentives, those things do work. So it's not a blanket, you know, a blanket objection as to what is happening everywhere. But the problems that we're seeing coming from the ANC is so big that it is actually throwing a pall over South Africa's future as a whole, the whole financial mismanagement. We're standing at a fiscal cliff at the moment. And then, of course, we see the policing is not working properly.
Yeah.
People are not safe. And this goes for all people in South Africa. And we see our hospitals failing completely.
Anton, can I get us into specifics here? Because if there's one thing that stands out for me, as an individual and as a citizen, is that you guys are very much for gun rights. And this is something I feel quite strongly about. I'm a gun owner. Yeah. I want to be a legal gun owner. At the moment, the legislation is so onerous as to make it almost impossible for anyone to comply. And if you do comply, you're only compliant for a short while. What are the Freedom Front Plus's main sort of talking points around gun ownership? And if this is a single, if I were a single issue voter, and how do you know I'm not, this might be something that persuades me.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We believe in individual freedom. So we believe that the individual must be able to protect him or herself, including their family and their loved ones and friends. And we know that we are victims waiting to happen. We are all statistics waiting to happen in terms of crime in South Africa. And we cannot wait until the police have fixed itself and the economy has been fixed to give everybody jobs. And much of the crime that takes place is not necessarily out of poverty, but also just because of pure villainy. And the individual must be able to protect himself. So we are pro-gun rights, absolutely. If you take away the citizens' guns, they are left to be slaughtered, and we have seen this time and time again. So the legislation must be licensed, and the individual's right to defend themselves must be supported and protected. Mm-hmm. And strength.
Well, we certainly are. We can't rely on the police. In fact, the police themselves have said as much.
Oh, yes. Oh, I mean, of course. I was in a police committee as a guest 2 weeks ago to submit my bill to protect public protesters in front of institutions where minors are held. And I told them that, you know, you guys aren't doing your job. And that's why we want to amend the Gatherings Act so that people cannot gather in front of schools within 500 meters because children, minors, and in many cases, primary school children and preschool children are being threatened just by the mere presence of protesters in front of those institutions. It's crazy.
Anton, I've got a quick question, Gareth, if I may.
Yes, Canton.
Anton, let's say that I'm in broad agreement with a lot of the stuff that that you talk about. I mean, I'm a huge fan of property rights, and I'm a huge fan of the right of people to defend themselves and so forth. But do you guys believe that you actually have the political charisma to be able to get voters to actually follow you? Because politics is ultimately all about your being able to persuade people that, hey, you know what, we are the leaders who are capable of actually delivering.
Yeah, rather than becoming a special interest group.
Yeah, yeah. We believe that we have the right policies for South Africa as a whole. And you might ask, how would we ever get to a point where we can actually implement them? And I think the short-term answer for us is looking at coalition politics. Once you go into coalitions, you have to bring to the table what exactly you want to achieve. So hopefully in Gauteng, and maybe an outside chance of national this year, but I think national is a little bit later. But there we will definitely play a role. And I'll give you an example. You know, the Green Party in Germany was a 5% party. But when they were needed in Germany, pre-Merkel, they came to the table and they said, listen, guys, we want a green economy, so we want you to shut down all the nuclear power stations before we say yes. And eventually the Germans said yes. And today you don't see nuclear power stations in Germany. In fact, you see green technology abounding.
You know,
and that's the point you want to take.
You know, Anton, if there's any theme to this morning, it is that that the smaller things do make a difference. So thank you very much, Advocate Anton Alberts from the Vryheidsfront Plus. And if you want to find out more about their manifesto, you can find it on various social media channels and on their own website. So there's another party to think about ahead of the election. We'll try to get to all of them before May the 8th. I think we can squeeze them in. How many are there on the national ballot at the moment? 5,326?
Well, those are the registered guys. We don't know how many of them are actually going to come up with the money. Andile, unpronounceable surname, come up with his money
Tama.
Yet?
Yeah. Well, I think his money's been taken away by Sokolika.
But also, you know, the fact that the election is effectively a couple of weeks away.
That's amazing.
It's such a damn squib.
I know.
All of the political parties, people are still scrambling, even the big ones. I mean, the
I'm
DA,
watching,
we only
I'm watching
saw
CR's pile of money and waiting for it to grow.
All right, can I just bring us back, because I think it's only fair. Canthan wanted to talk about something that he obviously is quite emotional, it's worth saying about.
Yeah, it is emotional.
It's maybe something that doesn't get covered that much, because we do like revisionist history in this country. And I do remember when Winnie Madikizela Mandela died last year, there was an outpouring of grief from South Africans. And just like Pumi and I were talking about the Michael Jackson revised history that's taking place now in the opposite direction, Winnie was eulogized by people as being this saint and this incredible human being who made only a positive difference to the world. And anyone who said otherwise, including Thabo Mbeki, who did at the time, was vilified. So, Canthan, go ahead.
I think to a large extent that's a narrative that was driven by the EFF. And, you know, obviously for the reasons that I've already mentioned. But very specifically, if you look in terms of Winnie's complicity in the murder of Dr. Abu Asfat. Now, I wrote a piece about this at the time of his murder 30-something years ago. When and essentially, Abu Asfat was he was a friend of mine. He was absolutely amazing person.
Who was he? How did he get into Winnie's crosshairs?
Health secretariat of Zapo at the time had his surgery in Lanesia, but then used to run a free clinic out in Soweto. And so every day he basically used to commute there and spend the morning dispensing mostly free medical care out there. He gave Albertina Sisulu a job at the point at which no one was willing to employ her. I mean, the woman was literally destitute. And Abu Asfat employed her in his surgery. He was the person who built the clinic out at Brandfort where Winnie was... literally in exile.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she took credit for it internationally, but he was the person who actually built it and equipped it and used to make regular trips out there. But Abu Asfat was the person who ended up treating Stompy Sepe, who was the person who, you know, the TRC fingered Winnie for her complicity in the murder of Stompy Sepe, who was part of the Winnie Mandela Football Club, who were, and this guy was basically killed just on the suspicion that he was an Impimpi. And coming directly out of that, because of the fact that Abu Asfat had been the person who treated Stompy and the other members who had been abused under the auspices of Winnie Mandela, he was taken out. And his killers testified under oath that they did so under orders from Winnie Mandela. And this is all part of public record. Now, what sort of absurdity is this when we have a person who has been so complicit in the most heinous crimes possible, where her husband stood up in court and said that he cannot bear to be in the same room as this person? And of course, we know this because media in this country actually broke the law at the time and defied the Divorce Act and carried his testimony in court. And we've got this absurd revisionist history that now says the woman was a hero. I frequently used to wonder to myself, what would happen if I saw her crossing the road? Would I be tempted to run her over? And the answer was yes. Absolutely. Because she was responsible for the murder of my friend. And I say this without hesitation.
Sure.
So, Canthan, edit, you know, and I think what you're bringing up is something that over the past couple of weeks, thanks to the tears of one Teralekota, is a conversation that's being opened up, and many wounds are being opened up in the country about who said what and who was killed because of what was said, and more importantly, the insidious nature of the apartheid government and how we don't know who was a spy and who was not. Mm-hmm. And we have very little information as to who could have been, because people were essentially just killed. And I saw the tweet exchange between Mandlalanga and Riditlabi about his brother, who afterwards it came out that he actually was not a spy. And everybody believed that he was. And then the order came from Lesotho for him to be taken out. And who the person that gives that order eventually. All those people. There are so many people in this country. And because we've never had full disclosures of who is who, simply because of the fallout that would come from it. And they are very, the people that should be on the record are also not on the record, because the TRC was not a full disclosure process. There are many
but
people,
if you look specifically at
state,
what Robert McBride had to say, if you look at what Robert McBride had to say when over the past couple of weeks, where he was talking in terms of his entire role, going back to the Magoo's Bar incident, and the fact that these were instructions that came down the command chain, mm-hmm. and that his reasons for not wanting to reveal the people who were actually involved at the time were to avoid a scenario where they would go through the same thing that he pretty much went through. So,
because there were witch hunts too, right?
Yes, they were witch hunts. Yes, and look, to a large extent, I know some of the people who are in the command chain in terms of the Robert McBride thing, and I understand his logic, and his point is that if they want to come forward and name themselves, then they should go ahead and do so. But I think we need to differentiate between that type of stuff where we know exactly what happened, and you've already had the ANC as a whole taking responsibility for those actions at the time before the TRC. Mm. The fact that the individuals in the chain of command were not named. Look, the buck stops at the top, and when the organization takes responsibility for it, owns up for it, and that's one thing. But revisionist history is an entirely different thing.
Well, I think there's so much we don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't matter. But there's a difference between trying to present someone as a paragon of virtue when it was very clear that they were pond scum.
I don't think that anybody is presenting anyone as a paragon of virtue. But I think that the real thing that we all came to confront with Winnie Mandela in particular last year was the duality of this personality in a time that was so so filled with so much distrust, not just of each other, but of the state. Of there were so many things that in the macro environment were coming to bear.
What kind of duality leads you to murder a teenage boy? No, come on, let's cut this.
Guys, when Voter Person says, I was just a soldier following instructions, when Voter Person says that it's okay, and when Winnie Mandela, who is also essentially a soldier,
she was not following instructions.
But she made a call. She made a call.
She was not following instructions.
But she made a call.
She made a call to take out a 13-year-old boy
who was supposedly a spy. When the information comes out later that he was not, so she made a mistake.
This sounds like a Mampincha defense. I'm not buying it. Sorry.
No, but my point is, at a time when there's so much shadow play. So much shadow play and so much at stake. We just spoke about the fact that the ANC did not win.
As someone who at the time was on the side of the good guys, and the good guys being the ANC at the time, what we expected of ourselves as people who were supporting the liberation movement at the time was a significantly higher ethical standard than the people that we were fighting against.
And yet the good guys did very many bad things.
Exactly. And
this is something that's so interesting, and I don't want to distract us too much down another avenue, but there are still people from the PAC who are in jail because they were inconvenient to the ANC. There are huge stories about what went on, because we obviously know more about some areas than others, because some people have come forward and others have not, which I think is a fair point from Pumi. And to move away from Winnie just for a second, there are loads of things that were done in the name of the struggle that were not things that the struggle wanted responsibility for, and that the people who were involved in the struggle wanted responsibility for. There were nefarious things. There are probably things that Jacob Zuma knows that he's still holding over people, which is why so many people are afraid of him. And parties like AZAPO and the PAC particularly were hit hard by the shadow play, as Pumi calls it, and quite rightly so, of the ANC's own internal fractiousness and its attempt to unify the movement at all costs.
A week ago, I had a conversation with somebody who was actually jailed at the time when Mandlalanga's brother was then named as being a spy. So six of them were taken in and kept, and they were young. They were in their early 20s, right? And kept apart from each other and tortured for days on end, days and nights. And he said to me, when the rumor, so today he says, when the rumor came that says they, the six of them, even though there were seven of them that went on the mission who were taken in, today they cannot say with certainty that the reason only six of them were taken in was because the seventh individual was indeed an informer, or simply because the special branch had decided to deliberately leave him out so that they could plant a narrative that says he was a spy. And that worked, right? Because the guy got killed. The guy got taken out. And because there were so many, and this is, for me, without all of the information, and all I'm simply saying is that there were many things, there were many, many things that happened, that people made decisions, because remember, the Central Command was out of this country. So people had to make decisions on the fly, right? And people made decisions on bad information, and people did bad things. People did bad things.
I think all Catherine is saying that those people must then be accountable for those things.
And she was held accountable. I mean, she was tried, for God's sake. There are very few people. There are people today who, as the information comes out of the decisions that they made and what they tortured, they are too frail, too old, can't remember to be put on trial.
She was tried for the kidnapping, and she was let off on a lesser charge in the first place. And in the second place, she was never held accountable for the murder of Abu Aswad. And let's be very clear, that was a political decision that was taken post-TRC. But I think we should probably move on from this at this point. I think I've pretty much made my feelings.
I've made my feelings
because
clear. Because I do remember Pumi was very, very upset when Winnie died too, as many of us were, because of what she symbolized, not necessarily the person herself, but who she was in terms of her symbolism to so many South Africans. And sometimes it's important to also differentiate between those two things, right?
And by the way, if we are to rename Cape Town International...
You want it to be Abu Aswad?
No, I want it to be Sarah Bartman.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, there we go. Let's just dip very briefly into the ugly pond of Eskom for a second, because the State Capture Commission is expected to continue unearthing the extent of corruption there. A national treasury official at the power utility is expected to take the stand. So what does all of this mean for all the people that we've heard of? The former CFO, Anoj Singh, McKinsey, Trillion Capital, the former acting CEO, Sean Maritz. I mean, what is your understanding of what testimony has already been delivered and who this puts the blame firmly at the feet of?
Oh, goodness. My eyes just kind of glaze over every time I look at this mess.
And we're not even halfway through the term. And this was always one of my reservations about this, is where to start with issues like state capture and commissions and whatever. Is always quite clear, right? Where to start. But how far back you go is then, you know, you're like Alice falling headfirst through a very, very deep and dark rabbit hole. Because then, you know, Trevor Manuel comes and says whatever, Figile Mbalula takes him on, and then after Figile Mbalula, somebody else wants to say something. Yeah. And then you're just going... Are we ever going to get to the bottom of this? And in the meantime, so even as things, at what point do we go, as things are revealed, Robert McBride and friends, you know, as things are revealed, how do we take those things and wrap up those parts, and move on?
Well, guys, we've discussed this over the past weeks, and really the point at which resolution comes is when you actually have the National Prosecuting Authority instituting criminal charges, and
so far crickets.
And so far, crickets. And so far, crickets.
Yeah, had a month.
Yeah,
still nothing.
Yeah, but you know, understand at the same time, she's got to be very careful in terms of actually purging all of the molds that have been put in place out there.
Sure.
Look, frankly, I don't think that there's likely to be anything that actually happens before the elections. I don't think so.
Do you think after the elections?
But this isn't exactly the best timing for the ANC, ahead of the election, State Capture Commission. But is it going to have any result on the way the electorate feels?
I don't think so.
No.
Sure.
I don't think so. Look, but what I do think is that there's likely to be a lower number of people actually pitching up to the polls than last time. So I think the proportion who end up voting is going to be roughly the same. But I suspect there are lots, there are disgruntled ANC people who will stay away. They're not going to vote for the DA. There are disgruntled DA people who are going to stay away. They're not going to vote for the Freedom Front Plus. They are...
Because they don't have charisma.
Yeah, and the EFF people, well, I'm not so sure. They might actually you know, get up and go to the polls. But I think the surveys show that even though people indicate that they want to vote for the EFF, that the people who actually get out of bed on election day are significantly smaller than the people who actually vote. So,
and they're not helping themselves. I think the worst thing for me is that none of these parties are helping themselves to get anybody to get out of bed and go and vote. And just watching what happened with the EFF's gigantic tantrum yesterday, Catherine, you live with the three-year-old. Wasn't it the same thing?
Watching can I play this clip for you quickly, and I'd like your comments on this, because this gets us back into Parliament, and it's fun. I thought this was hilarious.
I didn't see it.
ANC.
But on a point of order, Deputy Speaker.
What's the point of order?
Can the previous speaker please withdraw the word anarchy?
No, no. That's political statement.
Can you please withdraw, because he said the EFF were anarchists.
Honourable Member, that's a political statement. There's nothing wrong with it.
No, Deputy Speaker.
No, no. You can debate that outside, not now, please, or when you have a chance to speak.
Okay, it's
that's
fine.
That's not a procedural issue and so on, yeah.
Deputy Speaker, no, you're an anarchist.
Sorry?
You're an anarchist.
Me?
Yes.
Okay, Honourable Member, you withdraw that now.
Oh, why?
Honourable Member.
Why must I withdraw? You say he must not withdraw. Why must I withdraw when I say
Honourable,
to you?
Let me tell
you. You said he must not
Honourable
withdraw,
Member,
but I must withdraw when it comes to you.
Honourable Member, let me explain to you why. Because you don't understand the rules. Honourable Member. You, Honourable Member.
It was
Member,
a political statement.
Honourable.
I totally didn't see that coming. I thought he was going to say fine and move on.
Yeah.
But what you see here, the level of immaturity, of not understanding, as you were saying, the rules and the parameters thereof, and really, really.
But accepting it would have been inappropriate, because, and his point is correct. It's not whether or not he's an anarchist. It's just that, in terms of the point of order, it is completely irrelevant.
Mm.
So, but you
but
know,
he's
but,
unable
but,
to articulate that.
Yes, but you know, this is like trying to convince a flat earther that in fact the planet is round.
Who are you talking about, though?
I'm talking about the EFF person.
The EFF.
Yes, yes, because. Yeah, it's a spurious correlation.
But the EFF are spinning this out as a massive show of hypocrisy.
Oh, goodness.
They're showing, they're saying to everybody.
Nobody cares.
Yeah, I don't know. I think people...
Nobody
you know
cares.
What? This kind of thing, I think, has an impact on, you know...
Really
there are
stupid
a lot of,
people.
There are bumper sticker people out there who want a slogan, who want something rhetorical that makes them sound like they've thought things through, even if it's not their own opinion, and they're happy to go with that. This is ammo for someone like that, because they go, you see, the EFF are exposing the hypocrisy that the ANC have one rule for me and different rule for you. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, I think that anarchists should actually sue both the ANC and the EFF, because real anarchists would never behave like that. They're actually relatively
anarchists
civilized people.
Anarchists aren't found in parliaments.
Yes.
Yes. And it's not a bad thing. Like, they think it's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing, guys.
No,
it's not a bad thing.
It's actually probably quite a smart position. All right, so while we're in anarchy and parliament, the one place that is a total, absolute monarchy in Africa, and it's one of the few left in the world. It's an anachronism in a lot of ways. King Mswati III of Eswatini, he met with our president Cyril Ramaphosa yesterday. Swaziland kind of operates entirely within its own rules, on its own, does its own thing. The people in the cities feel very differently to the people in the countryside. The king still has complete control over everything, including the military, but he gets his money from all kinds of other places too. So he's not really accountable to anyone. What are the chances that we can have meaningful bilateral discussions with Swaziland that will result in anything positive for the people of that country or for our relationship with them? Is there a short, interesting answer to this, or
well,
should we move on?
Does anyone actually care?
Okay.
So
we don't care.
It's like Orania.
We don't really care.
Should we charge them rent then, at least?
Look, a significant chunk of Swaziland's money comes from us because of the fact that they're part of the SA Customs Union. Mm. I mean, I think some absurd figure like 50% of Lesotho's GDP comes via the revenue from the South African Customs Union. just to kind of put this in perspective. So technically speaking, if we revise the rules of the SA Customs Union, we can pretty much bring economic pressure to bear on them. But understand at the same time that Swaziland gets a lot of money from Taiwan because of the point at which Taiwan pulled out of South Africa, which was at the during the Mandela era when we
sided with China, mainland Chinese.
I mean, we basically acquiesced to the One China policy, and it was a good decision because in terms of economics, it made absolute sense to do so.
Sure.
And the Taiwanese actually left in a huff, even though at the time Mandela offered them full recognition short of diplomatic status. So in other words, he said, you can, exactly what the U.S. does. You can have trade representatives out here. We'll continue trading with you guys. But they turned around and said, no.
Recognize us as the only China.
Yes. And so they went up and started giving huge amounts of money to Swaziland, where they've been ever since. It's still Swaziland to me, guys. I'm kind of old school like that.
Yeah,
I still say Burma, not Myanmar, as an example.
Yeah, but that's for other reasons. Uh-huh. I can imagine. Uh-huh. I also call it Burma. Uh-huh. South Africa and Swaziland, according to the presidency, enjoy a very strong bilateral relationship, which is informed by our shared political history, culture, and geographical proximity. That's what Kusela Diko of the presidency had to say. Ramaphosa was accompanied by International Relations Minister Lindiwe Sisulu and State Security Minister Dipuwa Letsatsi Duba.
Mm, yeah.
So what?
We have very little time left, and I want to ask Canton.
As you wish. I'm sorry I even brought Swaziland up. It was such a waste of your time. Go on.
Swaziland.
Go on.
But so yesterday's big Karima Brown versus the EFF versus Editors Forum.
Just explain what happened there in case we missed it, because Karima Brown was essentially threatened sometime back and...
Not sometime back.
Oh, is it...
Two nights ago.
Oh, okay, so it was 2 nights ago. This is an old charge.
Because Canton is WhatsApp groups.
No, I just want to interrupt for 1 second. Do you remember earlier on when we first started talking about journalists, I said that there are certain people that I completely ignore and I never even mention their names.
Oh, is Karima one of them?
I'm not saying anything further. Can we move on?
No, you don't have to talk about Karima, but we must talk about the principles around what has happened. So I learned a new word yesterday.
By the way, she's completely repositioned herself. This is the woman who was essentially the
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Gareth, don't derail us. So the new word I learned yesterday was doxed, right? So
yes.
the publishing of people's private information.
Where they live, what their job is, what they earn, what their email address is, their phone number.
So I'm going to, it's safe to assume that Canton is not on the WhatsApp group that was the initial, that started the genesis of this entire thing.
Okay.
Because he's on a lot of WhatsApp groups.
Sure he is.
This Canton. So there was a circulation of what Karima calls a briefing notes.
Uh-huh.
And what the EFF have essentially decided is proof that Karima is running a political campaign against the EFF, right?
So right.
And therefore they published screenshots of this WhatsApp, whatever, and also her cell phone number.
Ooh.
And what then transpired is a lot of people bombarded Karina, phoning her, WhatsApping her, SMSing her, and she was threatened with all sorts of things, including rape.
Ah.
And we spoke a little bit about this
at this
last
point
week.
For listeners out there, Pumi is rolling her eyes knowingly.
Okay.
Knowingly. We spoke about this last week, and I said to you that the thing about the violation of women and women's bodies, what we saw with Pule Mabe and the guys, was weaponizing this thing. But also in South Africa, in the country that we live in, here the EFF has their supporters and they've not condemned any of this behavior. And what transpired is that it snowballed out of, first they put out a statement and then Julius was being talking about it and videos on the internet. And at no point did they stand up and say, this is not appropriate. This is not right. So whether the putting out of the content, never mind the fact that Julius cried properly when the details of where his wife and child live, that was so wrong. But it's okay for him to put out other people's information. But the fact that we find it okay, this EFF finds it okay that a woman can be threatened in this manner
simply
because they believe that she is a political opponent. The fact that they have decided that she's actually cannot be protected as a journalist, she's a political opponent, she's running a political agenda against the EFF, reminds me of a certain Congo and rebel fighters in the Congo. And there was a huge debate about this a couple of years ago, right? About
during
whether
the,
rape...
the civil war there, yeah.
Whether rape is actually a fighting mechanism. And I think that the EFF...
rape has always been a
history
weapon
will,
of war.
History will
rape has always been a weapon of war. And if you look in terms of... I mean, Bosnia is a very good example in terms
and
of...
And Russia and Germany.
Yes.
It's a form of ethnic cleansing. It's a form of...
But guys,
just the EFF are saying it's okay.
Listen, I just want to pull us back on track here in terms of this thing. The question about stupid media people who build narratives.
Yeah.
Right now, the EFF has been steadily pushing this one phrase, Stratcom.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing that consistently. And it builds up this entire idea that there is a conspiracy to actually undermine the EFF and that it is being funded by agents of particular forces. And everyone buys into this narrative. And nobody is actually turning around and saying... Show us evidence. At every time they use the word Stratcom. Because their spin doctors are out on social media all the time. They're bots, and they keep pushing the phrase Stratcom over and over again. And it's exactly the same as the narrative that went down with the rogue unit at SARS.
It's
just made up, and nobody stops to actually question it. And until we start actually smacking these guys down every time they try to build this narrative, because if you keep using the phrase over and over again, it's like Trump, you know, saying the fake news media.
Eventually
people believe it. Or it's like the Democrats saying Trump and the Russians. Eventually people believe it. So it's narrative building.
There are two interesting lessons we can learn from this then, if I glean from Canton's most recent comments on the matter. First of all, that we shouldn't believe everything that the parties are farming out at the moment, because some of it is just made-up bullshit. And also, there are media people who, while they don't deserve threats of rape, should also mostly be ignored, because it will be healthier for your sanity. It will be healthier for the amount of meaningful discourse that you might have as a result of avoiding that person's poisonous and stupid and puerile comments. And I see Pumi's point of view, too, as a third point to this, that clearly the EFF have no gumption and no qualms about weaponizing even the very insidious and dangerous threat of rape as part of their strategy. Some scary things in there.
Yeah.
Very scary things.
That's why the media industry is in such trouble, because our journalists are not doing the job. So what Canton is saying is they're not doing the job of smacking them down around Stratcom. They're not doing real hard journalism.
Because they feed into it. It's the soundbite culture. They focus on what people say and not what people actually do. And it gets us nowhere. So... I certainly think that anyone who is faced with a threat of rape should immediately press charges.
Right.
Immediately.
Spot on. So anything else you want to squeeze in? Because Pumi wanted to squeeze that in. Is there anything on your agenda, Canton, before we wrap it up? Or are you exhausted?
No, I think so.
We're not yet exhausted. We haven't even spoken about Gog Helen.
Look, no. I want to say farewell to Helen. And, you know, shout out to her. I think that she is, without doubt, absolutely the best premier this country's ever had.
Pumi, any comments on that?
Gareth, I actually saw your jaw drop in that moment.
All right. Pumi, anything for you?
Bona. Helen Ziller, I have no love for Helen Ziller. I have no love for Helen Ziller for many, many things. But I think the one thing that we must learn from Helen is, you know what, ne? Sometimes you've just got to quit while you're ahead. She should have quit and she should have put her phone away a long, long time ago. At some point, she did make some, you know, at some point, she started off down a particular path. she should have known that she can't, you know, she Helen doesn't have did, what it Helen takes to did, go past
Helen
this.
Helen did quit while she was ahead. She stepped down as leader of the DA. And, you know, big up to her for that. Again, you know,
what's happened?
She stepped you know, down from,
and,
from...
And where is Shenge today?
No, she stepped down. Essentially,
she was not forced out. She was not forced out.
Essentially, she sort of stepped down, but what she is still doing is
oh,
running...
Oh, no. That's EFF events. Spin. No. Take your Stratcom stuff somewhere else.
No one can do anything... To Helen, she cannot be disciplined by this party. She's above the party. She
nor should she be.
She
can't
be,
but can I
she
ask
can't
you
be brought to
book. Can I ask both of you something? When are we going to evaluate someone based on their achievements and the practical effect of what they've
that's
done
what I've
in
just
leadership?
Done.
I understand. That's why I'm bringing it up. And when are we going to start disregarding what politicians say, which is mostly nonsense, whether they're good or bad politicians, whether they're good or bad people, whether they're good or bad in terms of their opinion on certain things? Because whether Helen tweeted nonsense or not, which we know she tweeted nonsense, or she achieved things as premier, the one to me should bear a lot more weight than the other. I mean, the fact that someone can be held responsible for some drivel on Twitter, but they can't be held responsible for their actual achievements in office as a premier – seems to me a cognitive dissonance.
It's the reason why we keep getting the politicians that we have is because we keep up that stupid narrative. Pumi, I'm sorry. In this particular case, all of your stuff is driven by emotion. And none of it can actually trace back to what has Helen Ziller actually achieved in terms of almost every measurable thing that you can put in terms of how provinces are run, in terms of audits, in terms of housing, in terms of service delivery on the ground. Every single measure by which one holds government accountable, she has left the province in a significantly better place than it was before she took over. And that's all I'm interested in. So
I think she's left parts of the province at a significantly better place. I think she's left parts of the province.
Again,
and that's the problem.
And this is ANC narrative once again, because the parts that are not better are the parts that are under ANC control, where the DA was not allowed to go in. There are no-go areas in Cape Town. Where ANC people will
Cape
not...
Cape Town is not a province.
Throughout the province. Can we look at Beaufort West as another example? You are suddenly silent, Pumi.
No, carry on. You
dispute
see, for me,
dispute
so,
what I'm
no,
saying.
No. So for me, my experience, and as you always say, look, I'm... not a political analyst.
Are you going to say lived experience?
No, there's no other experience to have.
Thank you.
Right?
Okay,
there is no other experience to have. So from my experience and from the experience of the people that I have contact with, the problems that they have with the city of Cape Town and with the province of Cape Town is the differences between what some people have and what some people don't get. And the way that, and again, spin is a very important part of this conversation, is because we all sit up here in Joburg or on the other side of our Twitter screens and see and hear very selectively what is sent
I'm in Cape
out
Town
to
at least,
us.
I'm in Cape Town at least once a month on average.
And Cape Town is not the province.
And again, it's a city that I've lived in for a period of about 7 years, so I know it extremely well. And more to the point, in terms of the province, I'm one of the few people I know of who regularly does the drive between Johannesburg and Cape Town. So I know the province very well. And I challenge you to name specific cases.
Driving past is
not normal. But guys, I think also that, you know, that we can't have anecdotal evidence from either of you. I don't care how many times you've been in Cape Town. And I don't care who Pumi's talking to.
But we've got the
Cape
measurables,
Town.
Gareth. And that's the stuff
we've got to look
yes.
at. Let's look at the measurables. And on that basis, I think it is indisputable that the Cape Province, the Western Cape Province, has been run better than any other. And that Helen Ziller, as premier of that province, has been more successful than any other premier in South African
Absolutely.
Political history since 1994. I think we've got to acknowledge that that's an achievement, and well done to her. And I think the province is going to struggle to find someone who's as determined. My God, she's determined. She's determined to be right. She's determined to be wrong a lot of the time. But this woman was a force in politics in South Africa. And now she leaves office, and I think the Western Cape will find itself poorer.
Absolutely.
The All DA right. will be hard-pressed to find.
Well, the DA already finds itself poorer, right? That's indisputable. We'll see how they turn out at the polls. That's not looking good in any which way. So thank you both very much. Good Lord, there's a lot of contention in this morning's Burning Platform.
Yeah, it's just because Poopy doesn't like Helen.
Bona. She tries very hard to make herself unlikable.
You know what, Catherine? Don't make me say it's also true that you just didn't like Winnie.
But I'm very clear on that. Mm. And I've named my reasons.
All right,
thank you. And it's not because of Botox.
Thank you both very much. Ladies and gentlemen, The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. And we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. And this fantastic show will return in a week's time. Send us your thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. There are criticisms and there are praises for both of these extremely opinionated people in the studio. Good Lord. Get to some of those next week.
This is CliffCentral.com.